I ran across this news article this past week about Dr. Kent Brantley, who survived Ebola and was released from the hospital. And when he was released, he made a public statement, and the public statement was treated with some criticism by some in the press, particularly this Australian news agency, as it reported the news conference in this way. Dr. Kent Brantley's first public statement since contracting Ebola in Liberia almost a month ago kicked off all well and good, but it wasn't long before the 33-year-old's speech took a bizarre turn. Mr. Brantley's speech was an important milestone in the Ebola movement. He and his colleague, Nancy Wrightbow, are the first individuals to have received an experimental treatment and the first Western survivors to speak out after contracting the virus. But instead of mentioning the science behind the treatment that most likely saved his life, he took a spiritual turn. His speech soon sounded like a sermon. And after an earlier statement from his isolation room where he thanked God for his mercy and believed God often leads us to unexpected places, it should have come as no surprise. And then the article goes on to say some of the things that they found particularly bizarre. For example, it was language like this from Dr. Brantley. As I lay in my bed in Liberia for the following 9 days, getting sicker and weaker each day, I prayed that God would help me be faithful even if in my illness, he said. And I prayed that in my life or in my death that he would be glorified. I did not know thou, but have learned since that there were thousands, maybe even millions of people around the world praying for me throughout that week. And still, even today, I cannot thank you enough for your prayers and your support. But what I can tell you is that I serve a faithful God who answers prayer. He noted his colleague Nancy Wrightbow, who also contracted Ebola but was discharged on Tuesday, said as she walked out of her isolation room, "To God be the glory. Above all, I am forever thankful to God for sparing my life," he ended. "Please continue to pray for Liberia and the people of West Africa." Evidently, it must be bizarre for a Christian missionary to talk and act like a Christian missionary. I suppose if he had talked like a secular humanist and thanked the science and the doctors and all the hard work and all the energy that went into it, then maybe it would have been okay. By the way, I listened to the news conference, and Dr. Kent Brantley did acknowledge the doctors and did acknowledge all the help he received from the hospitals. But his clear focus was on God, who he believed had saved him, and on the God who he serves. Say what you want about the conference, there isn't any question about who Kent Brantley is or was. He is a servant of God. He is a missionary who believes in the power of prayer, and he entrusts himself every day into the hand of his God. Well, David is in the land of the Philistines, and there is a central question that has been surrounding me, at least when I read this text, all the way back into chapter 27 when David first landed or decided to move back to the land of the Philistines and disguise himself as a friend of King Achish. And the central question is, who is David? Is he a friend of King Achish? Is he a servant of King Saul? Is he a refugee? Is he a rogue warrior? Is he a citizen of Israel? Is he a servant of Yahweh? Or is he a man seeking his own security? Who is David? And the problem is, David can't be open and honest about who he is. When you put the microphone in front of his face and he's living in the land of the Philistines, in the city of Ziklag, he can't say, even if it's true, "I am a servant of King Saul. I am the king, the next king of Israel. I am faithful to God and to his people." Because if David says that, he fears for his life. Who is David? Now, you know when you read the story that at some point this question is going to come to a head, and David is going to be forced to answer the question boldly and publicly and up front. And you sort of get the sense that that's going to happen in chapter 29, because in chapter 29, a battle was brewing between the Philistines and between Israel. And the Philistine leader that David has been serving or submitting himself to, at least temporarily, Achish, comes to him and says, I want you to come and fight alongside me. I want you to be my bodyguard. I want you to protect me. And I want you to fight against King Saul. They begin to march together towards the battle. So you know that something's going to give. David is either going to proclaim himself to be a friend of the Philistines, or he's going to fight against the Philistines and be their foe. Well, God miraculously spares him from having to make this decision, because the other Philistine lords in chapter 29 come to King Achish and they say, look, this guy David is the guy that they used to say in Israel, Saul has slain his thousands and David his 10,000s. This is a war hero in Israel. This is a guy we do not want fighting on our side. We do not trust him. And Achish objects. He said, oh, I trust him. David's been real faithful and upfront and honest with me. But the other warlords outrule him, and they say, there's no way we're going to battle with David. And so Achish is forced to get rid of David and send him back home. And you can sort of feel this sigh of relief that must have come over David when he realizes that he got away with it again, that he's not going to have to confront the question of who he is, and he can go back to his family in Ziklag and just bide some more time and see what happens next. But then in chapter 30, tragedy strikes. David thinks perhaps that he's gotten away with it, but as the men begin to march back to their temporary home of Ziklag, they begin to see smoke and fire coming from the city. And as they get closer to the city, they begin to realize that the city, while they have been gone, has been under attack, that the women and children have been taken from the city, the men's families, that all their possessions and all their flocks and all their herds have been taken, and the city has been burned to the ground. They now have nothing left. And the text says in 1 Samuel 30, verse 6, that David was greatly distressed, for the people spoke of stoning him, because all the people were bitter in soul, each for his own sons and daughters, but David strengthened himself in the Lord his God. See, it was David who made the decision to go to the land of the Philistines. It was David who made the decision to engage in a relationship with Achish, a deceptive relationship with Achish, that had Achish believed that he was on his side. It was David's decision that caused the men to be marching into battle, potentially against their own people, and it was David's decision that eventually caused David's enemies, the Amalekites, who had come and invaded Ziklag, to take their family away and take all of their possessions and burn their homes and burn their city. Who is David? Now we're about to find out. We're about to find out in 1 Samuel chapter 30 who David really is. And for the first time, David will begin to speak and act like he really is, and that is the next king of Israel. There are six ways in which we begin to understand David and his character, and here's the first thing we find out from 1 Samuel chapter 30, is that David seeks comfort in the Lord. That was the last part of the verse that I read, but David strengthened himself in the Lord his God. Now you might ask yourself, what does it look like to strengthen yourself in the Lord? That seems a little bit esoteric, but if we turn to one of the Psalms, and let's just turn to Psalm chapter 25, which some people think maybe David had written about this time in his life. The context of it certainly could compare to it. But Psalm chapter 25 says this, to you, O Lord, I lift up my soul. O my God, in you I trust. Let me not be put to shame. Let not my enemies exalt over me. Indeed, none who wait for you shall be put to shame. They shall be ashamed who are wantonly treacherous. Make me to know your ways, O Lord. Teach me your paths. Lead me in your truth and teach me, for you are the God of my salvation. For you I wait all the day long. Remember your mercy, O Lord, and your steadfast love, for they have been from of old. Remember not the sins of my youth or my transgressions. According to your steadfast love, remember me for the sake of your goodness, O Lord. good and upright is the Lord. Therefore, he instructs sinners in the way. He leads the humble in what is right and teaches the humble his way. All the paths of the Lord are steadfast love and faithfulness for those who keep his covenant and his testimonies. And the psalm goes on and on. David could have written that in the time where he found strength in the Lord. And if you just heard what I said, if you notice a couple of things are going on here. First of all, David admits that he's in a horrible situation. David admits that his enemies are threatening, that there are treacherous people that are out to get him. But that's not his focus. His focus is on the God who has the power to save him. David admits that he's made mistakes, that he's been a sinner, that he's failed God in a number of ways, but that's not his focus. His focus is on God's mercy and on God's grace and on his love and forgiveness. So here is David, possibly one of the darkest days of David's life, so dark that his best friends now are talking about stoning him. And what is he doing? He's not focused on the situation. He's not focused on his sin, which he could have very easily been. No matter if it was his decision that sort of got them there, but he's focused on the God who is greater than their situation. He is focused on a God who can forgive sins. He is focused on a God who is his friend and companion in life. And as a result, David is strengthened in the Lord. That's what real followers of Yahweh do. They don't find their strength in circumstances or in situations. They don't bemoan their own failures. They don't beat themselves up because they're rotten, terrible people who can't get anything right. They focus on the Lord their God, who has promised to be with them and protect them. And that's what David begins to do. The second thing he does in chapter 30 is he begins to seek divine guidance. Now I say begins because we didn't see David seeking divine guidance when he went to the land of the Philistines in chapter 27, and we didn't see him seeking divine guidance, at least when he began to march with Achish to battle. But notice what happens in verses 7 to 10 of chapter 30. David said to Abinathar of the priest, the son of Ahimelech, "Bring me the ephod." So Abinathar brought the ephod to David, and David inquired of the Lord, "Shall I pursue after this band? Shall I overtake them?" He answered them, "Pursue, for you shall surely overtake and shall surely rescue." So David set out, and the 600 men who were with him, and they came to the brook Bezor, where those who were left behind stayed. But David pursued, and he and 400 men, 200 stayed behind, who were too exhausted to cross the brook Bezor. Now the question, should I pursue these men, to me seems like a non-question. That doesn't even seem like a question you ought to be asking, not because it's not a good question, but because of the answer seems rather obvious, doesn't it? I mean, you're a soldier, you're a warrior, and now some other soldiers have come and taken your family and taken your possessions, and they're going to sell your children into slavery, and they're going to do to your wives who knows what. I mean, isn't the answer to that, should I pursue them, isn't the answer quite obvious? Yeah, you should pursue them. Of course you should go after them, even if it costs you your life. This is what honorable men do. But David is careful before he makes the step. And I think the reason he's careful is because he realizes that maybe God has brought this situation into his life for a purpose that isn't entirely clear to him. And maybe God's bringing judgment on him, and maybe God's doing something else, and maybe God has another purpose. So he is cautious even about doing the thing that is obvious. Now, way back in chapter 27, David thought it was quite obvious that the easiest thing for him to do was to go live with the Philistines in the first place. And in that instance, evidently it was so obvious that he didn't bother to ask God whether it was the right thing to do or not. And that's the thing about obvious questions, isn't it? We might think we know the answer to the question. The question might, in our mind, 99.9% of the time, we're thinking the answer is always yes. And therefore, I don't need to ask God. I don't need to seek God's wisdom. But godly people who pursue God and pursue his righteousness seek his wisdom and they seek his guidance. And so David sought the guidance of God. He sought the wisdom of God because that's who David really was. I saw a statement from Nancy Reitbol's husband this past week who referenced her sickness and her illness And he spoke this before he knew she was going to be cured of the disease. But he said, just because she gets the disease, got this Ebola disease, does not mean that we have failed in our mission in Liberia. Did you catch what he was saying? That even if she, his wife dies, it is not a failure in terms of what they were doing. Why is that? Because they were being obedient to what God wanted them to do. And that's the advantage to knowing God's will for your life and being obedient to it. Even if you fail in the earthly sense, you don't fail. Because the success is being obedient to God. And God will use it in whatever way, to whatever purpose he intends, whether you live or whether you die. And so David is going to experience the freedom of knowing that he's doing what God wants him to do by simply going to God and asking him this question, should I pursue these people? And when God says yes, David knows for sure what God's will is for him. Because David is a person who obeys, who seeks and obeys divine guidance. Here's the third thing we know, is that David is a person who shows mercy. Now in verse 11, they found an Egyptian in the open country and brought him to David, and they gave him bread and he ate. And they gave him water to drink, and they gave him a piece of a cake of figs and two clusters of raisins. And when he had eaten, his spirit revived, for he had not eaten bread or drunk water for 3 days and three nights. And David said to him, to whom do you belong, and where are you from? He said, I am a young man of Egypt, servant to an Amalekite, and my master left me behind because I felt sick 3 days ago. He had made a raid against the Negeb of the Chedorites, and against that which belongs to Judah, and against the Negeb of Caleb, and we burned Ziklag with fire. And David said to him, will you take me to this band? And he said, swear to me by God that you will not kill me or deliver me into the hands of my master, and I will take you to this band. Now David stops the army to minister to some stranger, some person that he doesn't know, who hasn't eaten and drunk for a while, and who is basically laying by the road sick and dead. Now the army's on a mission. These men are out to get their wives and children back. They're out to find their families. They don't have time to stop and minister to a sick person. But David takes the time, stops the army, and ministers to this man's needs. Takes them a while to feed them. Takes them a while for him to revive his strength. And as a result of ministering to his needs, David finds out important information that will help them find their families. Now, I don't know if that was his intent from the very beginning. I don't know. Maybe David looked at this person and thought maybe he had some information that he could pass off or not. But I could easily see the men arguing that we don't have time. Our families are more important than this sick man lying alongside of the road. But David stops, and in ministering and showing mercy, he begins to find out important information. There is a lesson here somewhere for us. And I think that the lesson is this. Often when we are caught up in our problems, our focus is so much on us that we lose sight of other people. But if we would just stop and take a few moments and begin to focus on the needs of others and caring for other people and thinking about other people, maybe some of the burden we share of our own needs would be lifted. Maybe we would find answers to questions that we've been asking, not by looking inward all the time, but by looking outward, by looking for out to those who have needs, by looking to minister to those who have concerns that are just as great as ours. And David, in showing mercy, finds an answer, an important answer to the question as to where his wife and family and the rest of the army is, the army's family is, and so they are on their way. Because, you see, this is really who David is. David is a man who seeks divine comfort, who seeks divine guidance, who shows mercy to others. And fourthly, he is a man who is able to accomplish a great victory. We might even say a miraculous victory, because in verse 16 we read, and when he had taken him down, behold, they were spread abroad all over the land, eating and drinking, that is, the Amalekites, were spread abroad eating and drinking and dancing because of all the great spoil that had been taken from the land of the Philistines and from the land of Judah. And David struck them down from twilight until the evening of the next day, and not a man of them escaped except 400 young men who mounted camels and fled. David recovered all the Amalekites had taken, And David rescued his two wives. Nothing was missing, whether small or great, sons or daughters, spoil or anything that had been taken. David brought back all. David also captured all the flocks and herds, and the people drove the livestock before him and said, "This is David's spoil." Now, the extraordinary thing about this victory to me is that the men had been marching for days. They had been emotionally spent first in not being sure who they were going to fight for when they were with the king, the Philistines, and King Achish. Then they're emotionally spent when they get home and find out they no longer have a family, they no longer have a home. And now they've been marching for days looking for the people who took their family. And finally, when they get there, it says in verse 17 that they struck down from twilight until the evening of the next day. In other words, they fought from that night all the way through the next day into the next night, in other words, over 24 hours, and not a man escaped except 400 young men who mounted camels and fled. Now, it's interesting that it tells us 400 young men fled because that's exactly the number of men that David had in his army. In other words, more people escaped than David had in his army. He only had 400 men. He was outnumbered in a great and significant way, but God was able to accomplish a great victory through David, even though he was clearly outnumbered, and even though his men had to have been clearly exhausted. Where does such strength come from, you might ask, to fight such kind of battles? Well, verse 6 might hold some of the clue. David strengthened himself in the Lord. And you see, when you strengthen yourself in the Lord provides the necessary means, the necessary energy, the necessary power to accomplish his purpose. The next thing David does is, after he accomplishes this great victory, David then administers justice for the weak. In verse 21, verses 21 to 25, it says that David came to the 200 men who had been too exhausted to follow David and who had been left at the brook Besor. And they went out to meet David and to meet the people who were with him. And when David came near to the people, he greeted them. Then all the wicked, worthless fellows among the men who had gone with David said, "Because they did not go with us, we will not give them any of the spoil that we have recovered, except that each man may lead his wife and children and depart." But David said, "You shall not do so, my brothers, with what the Lord has given us. He has pressured us and given into our hands the band that came against us. Who would listen to you in this matter? For as his share is who goes down into the battle, so shall his share be who stays by the baggage. They shall share alike." And he made it a statute and a rule for Israel from that day forward to this day. The weak men who couldn't cross the brook, isn't that they were too weak to cross. It wasn't that they didn't want to fight. It wasn't that they didn't have the desire or the motivation. It was that they were simply physically unable. They were too exhausted to go on and too exhausted to fight. And as a result, some of the stronger men, when they return from battle, are resentful of these men who didn't go to battle with them. But David carefully and very judiciously stands up for these people and says, "Look, these men had an important role, they had an important task, they were willing to go with us, they simply weren't able to. We are going to share the spoils of them with them just as if they were with us on the battlefield." Because in effect they were on the battlefield. They kept the baggage, they guarded our rear flank, they were watching over us in some ways, they served an important function, an important purpose. They aren't any less important than you or I. In many respects, David reminds me of Jesus and his approach to people. You know, Jesus never discriminated between people. He treated everybody with great dignity, and he treated them all equally. It didn't matter whether you were poor or whether you were rich. It didn't matter if you were a male or a female. It didn't matter if you were young or old. Jesus treated people with great dignity and respect, no matter who they were, what they were, where they came from. Of all things, he even treated Jews and Gentiles and Samaritans with equality. This was unheard of for the culture and the people of Jesus' day. King David, in many ways, acts like this. He says, look, we are going to treat these men with equality and with justice. And as a result, there is a statute made that for years and years and years after David continued to be the rule in all of Israel. Because this is who David really is, you see. David is a person who was able to administer justice. And lastly, David was a person who identified with God's people. In verse 26, it says, when David came to Ziklag, he sent part of the spoil to his friends, the elders of Judah, saying, here is a present for you from the spoil of the enemies of the Lord. And then in verses 27, 28, 29, and 30, they list the towns and the cities where David sent these spoils to. See, in the past, when David was living in the land of the Philistines, and he had victory over his enemies, what he would do is he would bring the spoils, some of the spoils, some of the offering of that spoils to King Achish. But no longer is he bringing the spoil back to King Achish. Now the spoil is going to his friends and fellow leaders in Judah. Now, on one hand, this is a very smart political move because it's going to set up a situation where the people of Judah are going to be inclined to make David their king after Saul dies. But even more than that, what this is, it is a public declaration by David. No longer that who David is. He says, I belong to these people, and these people belong to me. No longer will Achish wonder whether or not David is on his side. No longer will the rest of the Philistines wonder whether David is on their side. No longer will the people of Israel wonder who David is a friend of. Now he is publicly stated, and everyone will know that David identifies with God and with God's people. He's making this a public statement. So what does David do? Well, who is David? Well, you can tell by what he does. He is a person who seeks divine comfort. He is a person who seeks and obeys divine guidance. He is a person who shows mercy to the weak. He is a person who accomplishes a great victory in the power of God. He is a person who administers justice for the weak. And he is a person who identifies with God's people, because David is a messianic king of Israel. And this is the way messianic kings act. And this is the way the ultimate messianic king, Jesus himself, acted when he came into this world and showed us himself what kind of a person he was. He sought divine comfort. He depended on divine guidance. He showed mercy to others. He accomplished great victory over sin and death when he died on the cross and rose from the dead. He administered and continued to minister, even to this day, administers justice for the weak and the outcast, for the frail, for the sinful. And Jesus is a person who identifies with God's people. And we're not always the easiest people to identify with. And yet Jesus says, these are my people. I belong to them, and they belong to me. That's who King David is. That's who Jesus was. But my question for you today is, who are you? If the microphones were put in your face today and you had to make a public statement about who you are and about what you believe and about where your hope lies, what would you say? What kind of language would you use? Would you talk about being a sinner saved by grace? Or would you talk about how you try to be good? Would you talk about being a person who is committed to following Christ? Or would you talk about how great a plan you have for your life and for everybody else's life and for the rest of the world? Would you talk about what it means to identify yourself as a child of the King, as somebody who knows God and who has a relationship with God and who is engaged in being obedient to God? Or would you talk about what it means to follow your own plan and your own devices? Who really are you? See, sometimes if somebody went to your work, or somebody went to your school, or somebody went to a place that you frequent publicly, and they pointed you out and they asked the question, who is that person who sits over there at lunch every day? Or who is that person who works in that cubicle next to you? Would they say anything about the nature of your relationship with God? Or would they say, I don't know. I don't know who that guy is. I'm not sure what he believes. I'm not sure what he's committed to. Do they know? Do you know? Or are you sort of hiding in the land of the Philistines, hoping nobody finds out? Look, you and I, if we belong to Christ, are a child of the King. We are joint heirs with Christ. We are the people who know the God of the universe. We even know how the story ends. We even know who wins in the end. We even know what's coming. The question is, do we act like it? And do we live like it? Or are we ashamed of it? Let's pray. Father, give us the grace and the power to live as children of the living God. Help us not to be ashamed of the gospel of Christ. And help us to know who we are and what it is you've called us to, so that we can find our freedom in doing that. In Jesus' name, amen.